John, I think some of them come from one source and some from another, and very often from mixed sources. Like everything, like the whole of our input.
Well, then he did not pay attention to what he eventually thought the thrust of these messages were, and felt that his life became disastrous. Is that a one-man story, or do you think there is, if you're getting messages to say, don't cross that street in your dream, and you cross them, is there guidance that you should listen to?
Well, there's guidance that you shouldn't. You just have to be able to know. I've been frequently saved sometimes from very drastic sanctions by listening to a hunch. Don't go in there. And I think you should always listen to a strongly felt feeling, a bad feeling. If I got a bad feeling about something, that is very important. And you override those bad feelings at your peril.
So all dreams can be regarded as hunches?
No, not necessarily. I don't think dreams and hunches are necessarily the same thing, although you may have hunches in dreams. Yes?
I agree with what you're saying about bad feelings, but the problem is not to become paranoid, so you start creating these.
Oh, absolutely. You have to be very careful on that point. I mean, some people get so they can't go outside the house, you know. God, you know, I've got a bad feeling about this and a bad feeling about that. But if you listen to it when it's strong, but don't let it take you over. There's always a necessity for maintaining a balance there. Yes.
Have you got your glimpses or clues of the movement
to
space from your dreams?
Oh, lots of them, yes. Lots of space-oriented dreams, or dreams of being in space or in orbit.
Do you have any thoughts about these rockets going up? I mean, I understand it's to the point now where the Western world has no capacity to launch any satellites.
I don't quite understand the question.
I just wonder if you have any thoughts about the, well, sort of, if there's any meaning to all these rocket explosions, you know, the Challenger and all.
Well, the only thing is, you mean the Challenger?
Yeah, and the Air Force had.
Yeah. Well, first place, remember that anything will come in series. If you have a bad airplane accident, watch and you'll have another in a few days. And sometimes the incidents are so similar. I'll be reading one. I said, didn't I read this before? And there were indeed two separate incidents, but so similar that you can't really hardly tell the difference. And that is one of the basic rules of life, is that good things and bad things come in series. The only rule of gambling, which is plunge when you're winning and quit when you're losing, or as Jesus Christ said, to him that hath shall be given, from him that hath not shall be taken even that which he hath, I guess. Which he hath. Well, if he starts doubling up when he loses, he won't have much very long. But that undoubtedly is one of the principal rules. And you can apply that to your own life. If you start out in the morning and the sun, everything goes wrong, and it looks like a bad day, that's not the day to take a lot of chances. It's not the day to try something new. It's a day to retrench and be careful.
Have you read or studied any on dream yoga?
Any what?
Have you read or studied any on dream yoga? Naropa's yoga?
I don't think I have, no. Is he speaking about?
I think the main point of that yoga was to remain conscious during your dreams.
Oh.
Of whether you are a participant within the dream or whether you are observing the dream. Is there any there's significance there. I'm not sure what that is, but whether it's prophetic or a signifying dream or whether it's just discursive man.
Well, yes, maintaining control and consciousness in a dream, that you find that in, well, you find in Don Juan. He makes quite a point of it. And there's a woman called Lynn Andrews who's covering the whole, the same territory from the female point of view. I've read all her books. They're quite interesting. Good Medicine Woman, and the latest one is Jaguar Woman. And all her her guides, her teachers, do make a point of remembering and holding your consciousness in a dream. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you, in my own experience, sometimes I succeed in doing that and sometimes I don't. But also, oh yeah, I know that I'm dreaming. And then you can, to some extent, control the dream or guide the dream. What is his name? Monroe, the Journeys Out, who wrote Journeys Out of the Body and has now written another book. That he makes a point of that, of going, being asleep but yet conscious. Various techniques for doing that. For going to sleep, but maintaining your alert consciousness.
Did you want to say anything about that? In Lynn Andrews' books, she's sort of talking very much about the key power, feminine energy, and what I was wondering what your take is on that.
On what exactly? Well, I just don't know, but I don't know, her book seemed pretty authentic to me. I was impressed by them, yes.
You talk about keeping yourself open, being able to see. Mm-hmm. You also talk in the preface to your latest book about believing in possession. How do you see that? Is it something that you keep at bay, this idea of possession? Is it something you don't want to have happen?
Oh, yes. Well, generally speaking, yes. Well, there's a difficult question there. That is, you laying yourself open to experience, and that's the only way that you can experience, but also there's a danger of laying yourself open to something that is very injurious. You don't. That's just it. You don't. It's like the when you let your immunity down there, then you can get AIDS. Well, I don't know. It depends on individual cases, but that has always been a problem of being receptive, but at the same time able to defend yourself against injurious attacks and influences. Because they're sure to be there. It's like disease organisms.
What is your personal belief on death?
Well, well, as I often said, how do you know that you aren't dead already? No, but quite seriously, the bardo, the period between death and rebirth, which is supposed to be populated by some mythological monsters, but I think it's much more likely if the monsters were too mythological, you'd wise up that this wasn't real. But if it was very much like your real life, you might very well be dead and not know it at all.
Those monsters are projections of your own mind.
Exactly, yes. Mm. But as I frequently said, I do believe in the possibility of survival after death. I think it's the only goal worth striving for.
So you think that consciousness continues?
It's yes, in some sense. Well, it's hard to say, but you shouldn't be clinging on to an individual ego, a me. In fact, that's the worst thing you can do, to try to hang on to your individual me, like someone like Mr. Hurst, who is obsessed with immortality. But he undoubtedly conceived immortality as Hurst.
No, it's a Bob.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the Dalai Lama was interviewed, and he talks about, I think he's being questioned about DNA and various psychophysical states and structures, and he says very clearly that consciousness can't be seen or measured or has no physical reality at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be seen only as a concomitant of something else, mm-hmm. as an accompaniment. We know that certain consciousness accompanies certain events in the nervous system. That doesn't mean that they're identical at all. Not at all.
But it's not matter, is the point. It's not.
No. Well, no, that's the thing, you see, matter, you pick something up, you have moved it, but it is not going to move itself. Your body is made of very much the same material as this paper, and to my way of thinking, it does not move on its own. It is animated by a spirit that it certainly has something in common with electromagnetic fields.
Mr. Burroughs, yeah. I spoke just a minute ago about DNA. I read an article in the paper a few weeks back about a research scientist in Duarte, California, who said that he converted some RNA patterns into musical notation and vice versa, and found that there were certain resemblances, like, for instance, some of Chopin's nocturnes turned out to resemble a gene, polymerase II.
Hmm.
One of Chopin's funeral marches resembled a cancer-causing gene.
Well, that's fascinating. No, I hadn't read that. Where'd you read this?
It was in the Denver Post.
Oh, that's very interesting indeed. If I'd seen it, I certainly would have cut it out. That'd be interesting, yeah. Well, he conducted extensive experiments, different music.
Yeah, there are several examples listed. There was one where an enzyme that breaks down lactose that resembled a lullaby. Various sorts of marches and things that resembled other kinds of genes. I can't pull the rest of the specifics out, but I can show you there.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Because the physicists are always trying to get something down to a field theory that will explain everything. And they get it all set up, and then there's another factor. Well, I think there's always going to be another factor beyond. They get it all, they thought, all set up, and there's something else. I don't know why they want to know everything. Yes. Excuse me. Yeah. Bring up what?
Dreams again?
No, go ahead.
In your own experience, did you find that when you started recording your dreams that the content changed? Or that maybe you had less nightmares or more? Or do you even record those?
No, I didn't, because I've done this for many, many years. Even before I started to write, I had a habit of writing dreams down.
Did you record even your nightmares?
Oh, yeah, well, I recorded, written down, yes. Yes, oh, many of them, yes. No, not at all. It's quite interesting. But many people remember nightmares, whether they write them down or not, but sometimes they won't. They just know that they had a nightmare, but they don't remember the content at all. One of the best literary uses of a nightmare was in, what is her name, McCullers. The heart is a lonely hunter, that dream that he had, which seems to be very archetypical. I've had similar dreams. You remember the dream? Well, is he was in an Eastern setting, and people are milling around, a complete silent. There's a terrible bright sun in the sky, the look of hunger in the faces. And he's carrying a bundle. And he's looking around, he's carried it a long while, he's looking around for somewhere to put it down. And he can't find any place to put it down. This growing horror of walking on and on through this silent, starving crowd with this bundle that he can't put down. And you wonder what's in the bundle. Yeah.
I've had the experience of writing dreams and cumulatively building up dream recollection until the dreams themselves become so complicated and exuberant and apparently meaningless that I get disgusted with the whole process and have to stop so that I begin to have more significant dreams. Have you ever had that?
No, I can't say that I have, Alan. Some dreams just seem rather dull and pointless, but usually those are not the exuberant or plentiful or variegated dreams. I mean, just you might dream of taking your clothes to the laundry or something. And but no, I've not had that experience at all.
You know, the more I pay attention, the more I dream, and the more I dream, the more complicated they get until they're finally unworkable or unusable.
I don't have that. I don't have that experience at all. Just not at all.
Okay. What's the relation between daydream and dream?
Well, I think daydream is a misnomer. Generally, when people talk about daydreams, they mean they're sort of vapid fantasies about making more money or seducing their girlfriend or that sort of thing. Well, that's not a dream, really. It's just often just a vapid, self-indulgent fantasy. I mean, if people do dream when they're awake, that would be, it's quite similar to dreaming while you're asleep. Yes?
I was just wondering if you meditate at all.
Never?
Oh, during meditation, sometimes there's something that seems to lapse into very much like what a dream is. I mean, it's not a conscious fantasy. Things are just going beyond control.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you meditate, and if you do, if it's possible to use the...
Well, no, I don't meditate, but I do achieve a state where images are going through my mind without, you know, without conscious volition, that is sort of undirected thought. And that is precisely what I always endeavor to do when I'm writing. To get, in other words, I'm transcribing a movie, a film that I see in my mind as best I can into words. And the less there is of my ego, my me in there, the better, myself, my identity.
Without, like, stopping it, changing it, but...
Well, there's always the difficulty of the actual procedure of writing. That is, you're there at a typewriter, and so it's you're never going to quite catch up with your thoughts. They're always going to be ahead of you. But, yeah, I think, you can achieve that state. I think that's what the Buddhists call it, undirected thought. But not completely undirected, because you're usually in your writing, you're in the process of, you've got some idea. Although, in many cases, I don't know what's going to happen next at all in my books. Just not at all. I get many surprises. Yes?
Do you edit a lot?
A great deal. great deal, about usually three or four times.
Back on this subject of ego and writing and so on, this comes up in some of the classes. Students mm-hmm. have unique, you know, more confidence, more ambition, etc. But the actual state, as people and many authors have described it over centuries, has been the actual description of the process has been one of sort of not even really being there in that usual sense. I thought maybe you could say a few words about yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mailer said I was a writer who may be possessed by genius, not possessed genius. Nobody possesses it. Well, I think it's always something that happens sometimes and not at others. And I don't know, you just try to recognize it when it happens and make yourself available. If I have to get up in the middle of the night and write, well, I'll do it.
We talked also in this class the other day about creating an atmosphere or rituals. Writer's rituals. I wonder if you have any particular, do you take a walk or have a cup of tea?
No, I don't have any set rituals at all. It's just sometimes it's good and sometimes it isn't.
Do you smoke a joint?
That helps. There's no doubt about it. No, it does. It actually stimulates the visual centers. Yeah.
People have said, among them Frank O'Connor, that a work of art is not only an extension of the object it represents, but it's also by nature very different from it. I was wondering what sort of separation you see between the written account of your dreams and the dreams themselves.
Well, any artistic description or any artistic transliteration has got to be imprecise. I could probably do, if I was a painter, I could illustrate some of my dreams, they'd be much closer, but words are pretty awkward to, often I'm describing very, not only very complicated, but very unfamiliar scenes. And it's never going to be any more than an approximation. Unfortunately. Well, that's just a matter of choice. You just know or hope you know what is good and what isn't, or what is better and what needs changing. But of course, writers are notoriously bad judges of their own work. And they do make mistakes. That's why I always want someone else to edit too. James Grauholt's done a great deal of editing, and once took out 100 pages from a manuscript. Most of them stayed out, but about 20 of them went back in. So I think it's very helpful if you have someone whose judgment you can rely on to look over what you've done, because. And another way, of course, is just to wait and go back over it in a month or something like that. But sometimes you've got deadlines and you can't do it. Yes?
You mentioned that you thought scientists spent too much time trying to figure things out. Maybe it was a limitation, but I wonder a lot about the why of things. Do you think those are sometimes questions better left?
Well, I don't know, that's up to the individual, but I just don't see why they have this passion to know everything. They think if we can know every cause, then we will know every effect. I don't think it even works that way. And I just don't understand their particular why that motivates them. I find them a very unsympathetic bunch of people. did you have a question?
Something along the lines of editing, which is what I've found is no matter what I do or no matter what anyone does, a certain percentage of people will think it's completely full of shit. Other people will say they can relate to it and they're getting something from it. So other than for technical corrections, does it really matter what anyone says about what you read?
Well, matter to who? Does it matter to you? I don't know. Well, of course, there's no doubt about it that the critics have influence. You have to care what a critic says if you want to sell your books, because they do influence the sale of books. There's no question of that. Good reviews are good. Just from that point of view. Well, it's a business.
William?
Yes.
When you were talking about synchronicity, I guess the synchronicity for me that I kind of can't let go of is that I just finished reading the Andrew's books.
I can't hear you. What was it?
I was saying that the synchronicity for me right now is that I just finished reading all of those Lynn Andrews books, and I still want to pursue that with you, and I was wondering if you could talk to what your connection with her is.
With who? Oh,
Lynn
Andrews. Well, she sent me her first book, and I was kicking around a long while before I was sort of ready to read it, and I was interested, very interested, and we started a correspondence. And I've had exchanged several letters with her, and now I've just finished her latest book, The Jaguar Woman. Why, the best of my, I don't know where she is. She may well be in Los Angeles. That's her permanent, her permanent address is Los Angeles. But she might be up with Agnes Whistling Elk in Canada, where she spends quite a lot of time.
She was here this year.
Oh, did she talk?
Yeah.
Where, here? I may have seen it. I saw, I've seen several interviews with her, and I imagine some of the same ground was covered. Were you there, Alan?
No.
Well, I'd like to hear her. I'd like to meet her in person.
John Steinbeck was there.
Bill, I want to bring up, just for a second, the topic of death, rebirth, and immortality, and so forth, which is much in evidence in the place of Dead Rose, and as I know, in the Western lands, in which you're comparing the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and really sort of saying that the Western lands is, talk about another kind of Book of the Dead, even though it uses the Egyptian nomenclature for the destination. And I guess the question is, are you familiar, first of all, with the concept of the Bodhisattva vow?
Perhaps not precisely. I know some. I have some acquaintance with the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
Well,
I mean, excuse me, the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Well, simply put,
Well, I don't see it. I don't think it can be quite that simple. That you mean you have to stay around until all the sentient beings have been saved? Well, you'd stay around an awfully long time, I'm afraid. When people are, as I say, they won't see. There's nothing you can do in many cases. Now, it's often a very costly illusion. To think that you can.
It seems like you've dedicated your art to the idea of actually waking people up, or
well, so far as they can be. I mean, so far as they see something, fine. But if they can't, you're wasting your time, I feel.
But the whole Bodhisattva aspiration is something that you've been, it seems, personally engaged with your art, not that you would recognize it or see this.
No, not exactly.
But you might have to come back in the next lifetime to continue this same workbook.
Who knows? I don't know. I'm dubious. Well, as Brian says, we are here to go into space.
Well, this consciousness could exist in other...
Oh, realms. Of course it could. Yeah. Well, I think that you don't just sit down and make a conscious choice about things like that at all. In fact, you can't.
Well, so presumably, enlightened beings could have a choice about where they'd come back.
Yes. Yes, but I don't think that it would be a conscious decision. I mean, you don't sit down and say, "I will do this," or "I'm going there." You sit down and then you are there.
Well, James was talking about the whole bodhisattva impulse would be to come back in a place where you'd be most affected in terms of helping.
Why other people? You know, I'm much more interested in animals now. the lemurs. We've got enough people. Too many. I don't know how Buckminster Fuller could have said that overpopulation is not a problem when the rainforest, which is the lungs of the world, is being destroyed at just a terrific rate of speed. There won't be any in another 50 or 100 years. They wake up and find you can't breathe. Those things happen quite quickly, not gradually.
Do you have any message to people who choose to ignore pieces of information such as that and say they would rather focus on the positive and uplifting aspects of their own life?
Well, I have no message. Message to people who can't hear it. As I say, you're wasting your time.
One more question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you walk around the block in New York and think about Mexico and see the nice
little
place.
What? Cloud.
When you're walking around the block in New York and you're thinking about New Mexico and then you see the New Mexico license plate, and then this stuff keeps on happening, and like let's say you meet a Judy, then you meet like three different Judys in about a week.
No, sure, that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happens and what do you do?
What do you mean, what do you do? It's just part of, what do you do about anything? It's part of life. It just, things that you didn't notice before, you're noticing now. It just expands your area of operation indefinitely.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. I hope that some of you will get this.